Chapter 7 Backers Goldman and SoftBank. The internet is like beer. The good stuff is at the bottom. Without the bubbles, the beer is flat, and nobody would want to drink it. Jack Ma. On its first day of trading on the NASDAQ, China.com, a company with only $4 million in annual revenues, on which it had lost $9 million, closed the day worth $1.6 billion. Peter Yip had listed only a small number of shares, so investors cast around looking for other China internet stocks to buy. The problem was, there weren't any. Seizing the opportunity, venture capitalists and entrepreneurs leapt into action. In Hong Kong, there was a sudden explosion of tech gatherings, speed dating exercises between young entrepreneurs and the investors that wanted to back them. One of the largest meetups was called I&I, short for Internet and Information Asia. The event had been around for a while, typically with a few people gathering around a table in one of the tiny bars of Lan Kwai Fong, just up the hill from the city's main central business district. But the China.com IPO changed all that. Suddenly, hundreds of people showed up at I&I, the venues switching to five-star hotels like the Ritz-Carlton, as banks and law firms tripped over one another for the right to sponsor the champagne and hors d'oeuvres. Hong Kong was ready to package the deals, but the market and the entrepreneurs to build the companies were across the border in mainland China. Suddenly, Beijing and Shanghai were awash in dealmakers. The China internet bubble had officially begun, and new dot-com ventures started to sprout up like weeds. Alibaba would have to fight for its share of sunlight. Media coverage. Before even the VCs had showed up, foreign media arrived to cover the China internet story. Jack became a regular fixture at tech and investor conferences around the country, his comments so quotable that the Los Angeles Times called him a soundbite machine. Soon after the China.com IPO, a Business Week magazine cover story named Jack one of China's webmasters. Alibaba had yet to generate meaningful revenues, but Businessweek predicted that investing in B2B e-commerce could mean an even bigger payoff than investing in China's three portals. On August 31, 1999, an article written by my colleague Ted Dean appeared in Hong Kong's leading English-language daily, the South China Morning Post. Ted had first met Jack a year or so earlier when Jack was still working for the government. In the article, Ted predicted that Alibaba may turn out to be a global powerhouse in B2B e-commerce. Jack laid out his ambition. We don't want to be number one in China. We want to be number one in the world. In our small investment consultancy, we were hearing a lot of those kinds of statements and were already becoming a bit cynical about the dot-com boom. But after interviewing Jack for the article in Hangzhou a few days earlier, Ted told me there was something about Jack that was different. I knew I had to meet him. When Jack invited me to visit, I hopped on a train from Shanghai to Hangzhou. I booked myself back into the Shangri-La Hotel, the same hotel where Jack, as a boy, had first approached David Morley to practice his English. After checking in, I took a taxi over to the Lakeside Gardens apartment. I was immediately struck by Jack's infectious enthusiasm and capacity to charm, influenced no doubt by growing up in a household where both his parents practice pingtan, the traditional art form that includes comedic routines. In his article, Ted had quoted Jack saying, "If you plan, you lose. If you don't plan, you win." After working in Beijing, the land of the five-year plan, I found Jack's spontaneity refreshing. Foreign professionals began to enter Jack's orbit, giving Alibaba an international flavor within months of its founding. Alibaba also had a strong component of female executives, adding to the achievement of women making up one-third of its founding team, in contrast to many Silicon Valley-based companies. Goldman invests. Meanwhile, in Hong Kong, shortly after their unsuccessful fundraising trip to Silicon Valley, Joe had started negotiations with Transpac, a Singapore-based fund, about investing in Alibaba. Soon they had agreed to a term sheet that would value Alibaba at $7 million. But Transpac insisted on an onerous provision, and Joe wanted to walk away. He then called up a friend at Goldman Sachs. Like Joe, Shirley Lin was born in Taiwan and educated in the United States. The two had met a decade earlier. For Alibaba, it would prove to have been a fateful encounter. In the summer of 2015, I met up with Shirley in New York to talk about Goldman Sachs' transformative investment in Alibaba in 1999. Shirley and I have known each other since 1999. We had been classmates at Morgan Stanley, the investment bank we joined fresh out of college. While I stayed on at Morgan Stanley, Shirley had left after a few years for Goldman Sachs to start making investments in technology and internet companies across Asia. 10 years before the Alibaba deal, Shirley and Joe had met by chance on a long plane ride from Taipei to New York. I was going back to Harvard. He was going back to Yale. We were seated adjacent to each other. She remembers Joe's face was buried for most of the trip in a book on constitutional law. He remembers Shirley intently reading the Wall Street Journal, cover to cover. After a while, they struck up a conversation. Contemplating the books and exams that awaited them back at college, pretty soon we were both lamenting each other's fate, Shirley told me. As Jack and Joe had already discovered, there weren't many investment firms in Asia with much experience in technology companies. In 1999, Shirley was already busily placing bets on China internet companies, ultimately investing in all three portals. Goldman invested directly in Sina and NetEase, and indirectly in Sohu. Goldman had given Shirley and her team a lot of leeway, provided she kept the investments below $5 million. This was peanuts to Goldman, whose principal investment area, PIA, unit, would make $1 billion in investments in tech companies from 1995 to 2000, one quarter in companies based in Asia. With so few funds already on the ground in Asia, Shirley was bombarded with requests for investment from her Harvard classmates and other friends pursuing the new wave of dot-com riches. The quality of the business plans was pretty low, often simple copy-and-paste jobs. Shirley and her team worked around the clock, wading through stacks of pitch documents, investing, she estimates, in less than 1 in 1,000. While the easy route was to invest in companies with at least one known quantity, founders who were classmates or friends, for the China internet story, Shirley had a strong preference in finding homegrown talent. I really thought that to invest in China, you have to know the local market. But scouring through China startups had its drawbacks. Traveling on unpaved roads in provincial cities, Shirley felt more like a loan officer with the Asian Development Bank than an investment banker. She also had a hard time being taken seriously. Even though we were at Goldman, people in China didn't know who we were. They asked, "Are you Mrs. Goldman? Are you married to the owner of this business?" They thought Goldman and Sachs were two people who owned the company, and I must be married to one of them. So when Joe Tsai approached her about a startup run by a local entrepreneur in Hangzhou, she was interested, particularly when he told her he planned to join the company. Shirley decided to fly up from Hong Kong to Hangzhou to meet Jack in late September 1999. Jack, she recalled, was as local as it gets. "I went up to the apartments, where they were all working 24/7. The whole place stank. Jack's ideas were not entirely original. They had been tried in other countries. But he was completely dedicated to making them work in China. I was moved by what I saw." As with Joe before her, Shirley was less impressed by the business itself than by the team, the real reason she would decide to invest. Who were they? What was their history? Knowing Joe checked one box. Seeing Jack and the team in action checked another. Really, it was all about Jack and his people. Shirley remembers being impressed by how hard Jack's wife, Kathy, was working. She and Jack toiled away, she recalled, like revolutionary comrades. Alibaba had been approached by other investors, but Shirley knew that the backing of Goldman would make all the difference for an unknown startup in China. They discussed the investment over tea. If Goldman invested, she told Jack and Joe, she would personally ensure Alibaba was known to the world. With B2B competitors like Meet China waiting in the wings and actively fundraising, the offer proved too tempting to resist. Shirley negotiated to acquire a majority stake in Alibaba for $5 million. She headed back to Hong Kong, where her colleagues Paul Yang and Oliver Weisberg drew up the term sheet for the investment. The following weekend, Shirley was swimming with her family at the Repulse Bay Beach on the south side of Hong Kong Island when her cell phone rang. It was Jack. He really wanted to do the deal, but asked Shirley to leave him more equity. If Goldman took a controlling stake in his company, he explained, he couldn't feel like a true entrepreneur. Jack told her how he'd put everything into the venture. "This is my life," he said. Shirley replied, "What do you mean, this is your life? You've only just started." Jack explained, "But this is my third venture already." Jack finally convinced her. The term sheet for the investment had been drawn up, but there were brackets around the numbers, so it would be an easy change. Goldman would invest the $5 million for 500,000 shares, half the company, while retaining veto rights over key decisions. Just after she had agreed to the new terms, mid-conversation with Jack, she accidentally dropped her cell phone into the sea. Oops, she thought to herself. Well, I guess there goes $5 million. Jack had succeeded in securing a big-name investor in what would prove a critical step in Alibaba's story. But he would also come to regret selling such a large stake in the company, 50%, which he would never recoup. In reality, though, Jack had little choice. He was an unproven entrepreneur, based in a provincial city in China, who was negotiating with a huge global financial institution. But having already given out a lot of equity to his co-founders, and now 50% to investors, he ended up with a much lower share of his company than many of his peers. Jack would later joke, only half kidding, that it was the worst deal I ever made. When Shirley took the deal to her investment committee, which oversaw all the fund's investments, she encountered an unexpected snag. They pushed back. If Goldman invested the full $5 million, the fund would need to gain the approval of their investors. "Please get rid of some," they told her. So Shirley reduced Goldman's stake to 33%. Now she quickly had to find investors for the other 17%. Today, the thought of having to cast urgently around for buyers willing to pay $1.7 million for a 17% stake in Alibaba, now worth tens of billions of dollars, is laughable. In the end, she brought in Thomas Eng of Venture TDF, who had met Jack and Joe that summer in Palo Alto for $500,000. Fidelity Growth Partners Asia came in for another $500,000. Joe had already told his employer that he was going to join a startup in China. When Joe informed his boss, Galeazzo Scarampi, that he had found investors and was going to leave to join Alibaba, investor AB also came in for a slice. Transpac rounded out the balance of the $1.7 million investment alongside Goldman's $3.3 million. Some of the investors, including Venture TDF and Fidelity, held on to their stakes all the way through Alibaba's 2014 IPO, generating returns of billions of dollars. When the Goldman-led round was finalized on October 27, 1999, the investment cemented Joe's authority as Jack's right-hand man. The $5 million round led by Goldman was a start, but peanuts compared to the war chest of the three China portals, who were besieged by eager investors as the NASDAQ began its vertiginous climb, gaining 80% in 8 months, valuing its component companies at $6.7 trillion in early 2000. All eyes were on the companies who positioned themselves as the Yahoo of China, as well as the moves of Yahoo itself in China. In September 1999, Yahoo, then valued at $36 billion, announced a partnership with Founder, the largest local PC manufacturer at the time, targeting the mainland. At the same time, Sohu, Sina, and NetEase ramped up their fundraising. Sina would raise the most, including $60 million in November 1999 from investors, including Goldman Sachs and SoftBank, putting the company in pole position for an IPO in the United States. Sohu raised $30 million. Its founder, Charles Zhang, capturing the mood of the day. This is a game of spending money and how fast you can spend money. Even William Ding at NetEase relented, raising in two rounds $20 million from investors, including Goldman Sachs, but not without venting his frustration that now, people never ask you about your new products. They only ask you, when is your IPO? On October 7th, Alibaba tried to grab some of the limelight with a press conference in Hong Kong to announce a new version of its website and disclosing that it was open to an IPO in the United States or on the planned second board of the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, the growth enterprise market. Caught up in the excitement of Hong Kong, Alibaba also announced that it would move its headquarters there from Hangzhou. Jack had been spending most of his time in Hong Kong, working with Joe and some new recruits out of a conference room in Goldman's office. The contrast couldn't have been greater between Alibaba's humble, second-floor Lakeside Gardens apartment in Hangzhou and its new perch atop the gleaming Citibank Plaza skyscraper with breathtaking views over Victoria Harbor. To support Goldman's newest portfolio company, Shirley Lin conducted a series of interviews with media in Hong Kong, even going on local television stations to spread the word about Alibaba. "My Cantonese was so bad back then, they had to subtitle me," she recalls. When Goldman moved to even shinier new offices atop billionaire Li Ka-shing's brand new Cheung Kong Center, Alibaba signed a lease on its own impressive and expensive new space, the first major outlay from Goldman's $5 million that had hit the bank. Alibaba could get down to business. Its business was simple: to become the leading website in China for business-to-business leads. To match buyers with sellers, Alibaba organized its members' postings into 27 industry sectors, such as apparel and fashion, electronics and electrical, and industrial supplies. Users could sign up for free to receive notification of trade deals and search for offers to buy or sell within a sector or a geographical area. By October 1999, Alibaba had signed up more than 40,000 users. Now it had to go for a much higher quantity of users while maintaining the quality of the messages tacked onto its virtual bulletin board. Most of the sellers on its site were export or trading companies in China, including a strong representation of firms led by Zhejiang entrepreneurs. The internet was still new for many of these firms, but they quickly became loyal users of Alibaba.com. Many lacked the scale or connections needed to trade through the state-owned trading companies, and some were located in remote areas that made traveling to trade shows like the Canton Fair too expensive. Having grown up among them and served them as clients of Hope Translation and China Pages, Jack had a keen sense of what these small firms needed. Most SMEs, small and medium enterprises, have a very changeable dynamic. Today they might sell t-shirts. Tomorrow it could be chemicals. To attract buyers, Alibaba needed to ensure vendors' listings were translated accurately into English. Drawing on the talent pool of university graduates in Hangzhou, Alibaba started to hire English-speaking editors to ensure that the posts on the bulletin board were complete, intelligible, and properly categorized. Leveraging his contacts from MoveTech in Beijing, Jack also hired recruits with trade know-how to make the website attractive to foreign buyers. Posting on the site, for buyers and sellers, was free, a central tenet of Jack's approach throughout his career. His "if you build it, they will come" approach helped him pull clear of any rivals. If visitors to Alibaba.com were able to make new trade leads, he figured, they would demonstrate increasing loyalty, or stickiness, to the website. But while free was great for users, it was a tough business model. Alibaba was vulnerable to any downtime in the internet funding frenzy. Also, as traffic grew dramatically on Alibaba's website, maintaining the quality of postings was a big job. If Alibaba wasn't careful, it could be overwhelmed. Another challenge was the increasing competition for talent. In the dot-com boom, skilled employees constantly jumped ship to rival ventures or, tapping the growing pool of venture funding, tried their luck at their own startups. The cost of talent started to spiral upward, including for the software developers, web designers, and project managers that Alibaba would need to build out its offerings. Here, Alibaba had two important things going for it: Hangzhou, and Jack Ma. Unlike Beijing and Shanghai, where turnover of qualified employees was a major headache for entrepreneurs, Hangzhou had a deep pool of fresh graduates and very few local employers. In addition, Alibaba benefited from Hangzhou's relative isolation. There weren't really any rivals to poach his employees. A few other technology firms were located in the town, such as UT Starcom or Eastcom, but in the dot-com craze, these were fast becoming old economy ventures. Alibaba also benefited from Hangzhou's distance from Shanghai, then some 2 hours away. For young, talented engineers in Hangzhou who wanted to work for a fast-growing internet venture, Alibaba was it. This helped keep costs low, too. For the price of one engineer in Beijing or Shanghai, Alibaba could hire two. The comparison with Silicon Valley was even more dramatic. As Jack pointed out, to keep one programmer happy in Silicon Valley takes $50,000 to $100,000. For that much money in China, I can keep 10 very smart people happy all the time. As a second-tier city, real estate was cheaper in Hangzhou, too. Even after Alibaba moved into a 200,000-square-foot office in early 2000, its total rental bill was just $80,000 a year, a fraction of what it would have been in Beijing or Shanghai. Jack liked the distance from Beijing. Even though the infrastructure is not as good as in Shanghai, it's better to be as far away from the central government as possible. Ali people. When building up his team, Jack preferred hiring people a notch or two below the top performers in their schools. The college elite, Jack explained, would easily get frustrated when they encountered the difficulties of the real world. For those who came aboard, working for Alibaba would be no picnic. The pay was low. The earliest hires earned barely $50 per month. They worked 7 days a week, often 16 hours a day. Jack even required them to find a place to live no more than 10 minutes from the office so they wouldn't waste precious time commuting. From the outset, Alibaba has been driven by a Silicon Valley-style work ethic, with every employee issued share options in the company, vesting over a 4-year period. This is still a rarity in China, where the traditional setup in private companies was an emperor-like boss who treated employees as disposable and salaries as discretionary. As the Alibaba.com website grew in popularity, aided by offering its services for free, the team in Hangzhou struggled to keep up with the volume of incoming emails. Alibaba's customer service team found themselves at times acting as free tech support to clients, responding to questions about how to reboot a computer. But wedded to its customer-first tenet, Alibaba resolved to respond to every email within 2 hours. Keeping the team focused, co-founder Simon Xie recalled, Jack was a culture, a nucleus. Jack greeted new recruits with a sobering message and a promise, then trotting out one of his favorite sayings, "Today is brutal, tomorrow is more brutal, but the day after tomorrow is beautiful. However, the majority of people will die tomorrow night. They won't be able to see the sunshine the day after tomorrow. Aliren must see the sunshine the day after tomorrow." Co-founder Lucy Pang, Alibaba's first human resources director and later its chief people officer, also played an important role in the hiring process and in shaping the company's culture. In a 2000 Harvard Business School case study on the company, she commented that Alibaba employees don't need experience. They need good health, a good heart, and a good head. As the website's members grew, companies in China began to use the site to connect with one another as well as to the outside world, prompting the launch of a Chinese language marketplace for wholesalers in China seeking domestic trade leads. Yet Alibaba still encountered difficulties winning converts to the e-commerce cause. Some balked at the high costs of buying computers. Others lacked personnel with a sufficient understanding of IT. An even bigger obstacle was a pervasive lack of trust. Suppliers worried that customers they had never met might never pay for their orders. Buyers overseas were concerned about fake or defective goods or shipments that never arrived. Alibaba couldn't wave a magic wand to make these risks go away, as Jack emphasized to the media. We are just a platform for business people to meet, but we do not take legal responsibility. Alibaba kept its focus as a bulletin board for businesses, but others, such as Meet China, were talking up their plans to expand into areas like market research, credit checks on suppliers, quality inspections, shipping, insurance, and payments. Jack argued this was premature. Small and medium-sized companies do not trust transactions online yet, and we believe the current banking system is good enough for small business. As long as our members feel it's easy, they'd prefer to do their transactions offline. Alibaba was struggling to define itself in ways that investors could understand. We don't really have a clearly defined business model yet, Jack admitted. If you consider Yahoo a search engine, Amazon a bookstore, eBay an auction center, Alibaba is an electronic market. Yahoo and Amazon are not perfect models, and we're still trying to figure out what's best. Goldman's cash had helped, but the commitment to free listings meant that Alibaba had to raise more capital soon, something made more pressing by the opening of the new Hong Kong office and another in Shanghai, which Alibaba announced would serve as its new China headquarters. To sign up more customers, Alibaba started to host gatherings of SMEs in hotel ballrooms, arranging tables to group together companies from similar industries. Despite the hectic pace during the internet bubble and the growing sense of inevitability that it would soon pop, Jack betrayed few signs of anxiety. I visited Hangzhou several times in late 1999 and 2000 and witnessed Alibaba sprout from the lakeside apartment through a series of ever larger offices. I never witnessed Jack lose his cool. Even when he dinged the fender of his car one day on a concrete column when we were parking at a restaurant where he'd invited me to lunch. I always found my visits to Hangzhou enjoyable. Spending time with Jack was invariably good fun. Like many visits before and since, I enjoyed seeing the city's sights. On one visit, Jack's wife Kathy took me to visit the famous Longjin Dragon Well tea plantations, including a walk through the bamboo forest nearby. A breath of fresh air, literally, after Beijing. Jack was now spending much of his time away from Hangzhou, speaking at industry and investor conferences. In January 2000, we were both invited to speak at a student-organized event at Harvard. I met up with Jack before the conference. As we walked along an icy pathway on the banks of the Charles River, I noticed one of his entourage was filming the scene. Something I later discovered she had been doing for years already. The conference featured a number of other China internet entrepreneurs, most with much stronger academic pedigrees than Jack. Some were recent returnees to China, like Xiao Yibo of EachNet, who had actually studied at Harvard. Peter Yip from China.com was also there. But Jack quickly emerged as the star of the show, especially when he confessed to the audience that he really had no idea what Alibaba's business model was, adding, "And yet I got investment from Goldman Sachs." Jack reveled in the attention he received at Harvard, including the moniker Crazy Jack that Time magazine gave him shortly after. He particularly enjoyed talking about the reversal of fortune of being once rejected by Harvard, but later being invited there to give a talk. "I did not get an education from Harvard. I went to Harvard to educate them." Jack has always been dismissive of business schools. It is not necessary to study an MBA. Most MBA graduates are not useful. Unless they come back from their MBA studies and forget what they've learned at school, then they will be useful. Because schools teach knowledge, while starting businesses requires wisdom. Wisdom is acquired through experience. Knowledge can be acquired through hard work. SoftBank invests. One of the reasons that Jack was on such a high at Harvard was that he was on the verge of announcing another important milestone for Alibaba, $20 million in fresh funding from the Japanese investment firm SoftBank. With this and a subsequent investment, SoftBank became Alibaba's largest shareholder. The deal was teed up by Alibaba's investor, Goldman Sachs. SoftBank was on the lookout for tech investment opportunities in China when Mark Schwartz, then president of Goldman Sachs Japan, told Masayoshi Son, SoftBank's founder, about the bank's growing portfolio of tech investments in China. In October 1999, Jack was one of several entrepreneurs invited to meet Masayoshi Son in one of a series of speed dating sessions between the Chinese startups and the Japanese billionaire, arranged by Chauncey Hsieh, president of SoftBank China Venture Capital. The two men met at the wedding cake-styled Fuhua Mansion in Beijing. The venue turned out to be a fitting one, their meeting the start of an enduring partnership that would eventually make Son the richest man in Japan. Son's backing of Jack, coming just months before the dot-com crash, transformed Alibaba's fortunes. Masayoshi Son. Masayoshi Son, known to his friends as Masa, shares some similarities with Jack. Both are short in stature and known for their outsized ambitions. Son grew up in circumstances even more difficult than Jack's. Born on Japan's southernmost main island of Kyushu, the sons lived in a shack that didn't even have an official address. His father was a pig farmer who brewed moonshine on the side. Son was bullied for being ethnically Korean and was forced to adopt the Japanese surname Yasumoto. At the age of 16, Son moved to Northern California in search of a brighter future. Staying with friends and family, he attended Serramonte High School in Daly City, just south of San Francisco, before gaining acceptance to the University of California, Berkeley, where he started his entrepreneurial career. His most successful venture was building a voice-operated translation device to be sold at airport kiosks. Son designed, built, and then licensed the technology to Sharp Electronics for $500,000. In the United States, Son started to import early models of the Pac-Man and Space Invaders game consoles that were becoming popular at the time, leasing them to local bars and restaurants, including Yoshi's, a North Berkeley sushi bar, now a famous Bay Area jazz venue. At Berkeley, he also met and hired Liu Hongliang, whose venture, Unitech Industries, renamed Unitech Telecom in 1994, later became part of the technology venture UT Starcom, the Hangzhou-based company in which SoftBank invested in 1995. After moving back to Japan in the early 1980s, Sun started a software distribution company. At the launch of the venture, in a scene echoing Jack's own irrepressible optimism, he famously climbed on top of a shipping box in front of his employees, just two at the time, both working part-time, and vowed that their new venture would make 50 billion yen, $3 billion, in revenues within 10 years. By the time he first met Jack, Sun had become a billionaire many times over. He was known for making quick decisions. One of his best was the prescient investment he made in Yahoo in 1995. When Yahoo went public in 1996, Sun topped up SoftBank's stake in the portal to 37%, becoming its largest investor. Sun also negotiated the right for SoftBank to become Yahoo's exclusive partner in Japan, a deal that would yield him tens of billions more. Meeting Sun, Jack knew he had found a kindred spirit. "We didn't talk about revenues. We didn't even talk about a business model. We just talked about a shared vision. Both of us make quick decisions," Jack recalled. "When I went to see Masayoshi Son, I didn't even wear a suit that day. After 5 or 6 minutes, he began to like me and I began to like him. People around him have said that we are soulmates." At their first meeting, after Jack had finished describing Alibaba, by now some 100,000 members strong, Son immediately turned the conversation to how much SoftBank could invest. "I listened to Mr. Ma's speech for 5 minutes and decided on the spot that I was ready to invest in Alibaba," Son recalled. Son interrupted Jack's presentation to tell him he should take SoftBank's money because he should spend money more quickly. Around the time of Alibaba's 2014 IPO, Son was asked what it was that prompted him to bet on Jack back in 2000. "It was the look in his eye. It was an animal smell. It was the same when we invested in Yahoo, when they were still only 5 to 6 people. I invested based on my sense of smell. This impulsiveness was typical for Sun. Masa is Masa. He has ADD, attention deficit disorder, and can't sit still. He just wants to give you money now, commented a former business associate. A few weeks after their first meeting in Beijing, Sun invited Jack to Tokyo to finalize terms. Joe Tsai joined him on the trip. As soon as they entered Sun's office, the negotiations began. Jack would later infuse his description of their meeting with martial art imagery. Masters of negotiation always listen, don't talk. Those who talk a lot only have second-rate negotiation skills. A true master listens, and as soon as he moves his sword, you pretty much collapse. Joe, who had met up with SoftBank China's Chauncey Hsieh before the trip, told me the details of their meeting. Goldman and the other funds had just invested $5 million for half of the company, valuing Alibaba at $10 million. Masa opened the negotiations by offering $20 million for 40% of the company. This valued Alibaba at $50 million post-money and $30 million pre-money. In just weeks, Goldman's investment had increased in value by three times. Joe and Jack looked at each other, Joe recalled, thinking, "Woohoo, that's three times." But then we thought, we don't want to give up too much equity. So Jack said, "Masa, that doesn't work for us." Masa had a calculator. He was literally doing the math right there. But Masa wanted 40%, so he said, "How about double the amount? I put $40 million for 40%. That means $60 million pre-money." Jack and Joe offered to think it over. Upon their return to China, Jack wrote Sun an email turning down the $40 million investment. Instead, he offered to take in $20 million for 30%, adding, "If you agree, we will go ahead. If not, that's it." Jack later explained why he turned down the larger amount. "Why would I need to take so much money? I didn't know how to use it, and there would definitely be problems." Jack didn't have to wait long for his reply from Sun, which came in the form of two words, "Go ahead." Jack credits fortune with playing a hand in connecting him with Sun, conceding that it is quite difficult to find such an investor. Commenting on the dynamics of their relationship, Jack said, "I think Masa is definitely one of the world's best businessmen, very sharp on investment. But," he adds, "Sun is also a good operator of business, too. It's not easy to shift from investor to operator and meanwhile still be a good investor. For me, I'm just an operator. I love to be an entrepreneur. I'm not a good investor." Jack also liked to joke about their appearances. "The difference between me and him is that I may look very smart, but in fact I am not. That guy seriously doesn't look very smart, but he is a very wise person." An early Alibaba employee, Xiao Yuan, has an interesting take on the relationship between the two founder CEOs. Sun has a lot of self-confidence. He's even conceited. But his appearance is always one of modesty. He's crazy, but Ma's also crazy. It's very common for crazy people to like each other. Announcing the deal, Sun himself drew a comparison with his wildly successful investment in Yahoo. "We would like to make Alibaba the next Yahoo. I think this will probably be the first Chinese internet company which will become a global brand, a global success in a big way. I am very excited to make that happen." The two firms also announced a joint venture for Alibaba Korea, which would launch in June 2000, to fend off the growth of a local player there, and drew up plans for a site in Japan as well. The deal was clearly a transformative one for Alibaba, and cause for celebration. In less than a year after the company's founding, Jack and Joe had reeled in $25 million from two of the largest and most prestigious investors in the world. The deal was not without a price. The sale of 30% of Alibaba to SoftBank came on the heels of the sale of 50% of the company to Goldman Sachs, meaning a hefty dilution of Jack's stake. Yet the SoftBank investment provided Alibaba with serious street cred in China, just as the three Chinese internet portals geared up for their U.S. IPOs. The deal also gave Alibaba insurance. No one could predict with any certainty how long the tech investment boom would last. SoftBank's $20 million allowed it to build out a much longer runway on which to achieve takeoff and future profitability. Jack wanted to be noticed in Silicon Valley, too. Soon after he secured the $20 million investment from SoftBank, Jack headed to Santa Clara, California, the home of Yahoo. He traveled there to offer John Wu, a Yahoo executive whom Jack had first met when working at China Pages, the post of Chief Technology Officer of Alibaba. It was an ambitious pitch. Jack was proposing that John take a 50% pay cut and leave the hottest company in Silicon Valley for a risky startup in Hangzhou. John expressed his misgivings to Jack, as he later recalled, "Yahoo was doing well. My parents were immigrating to the U.S. I wasn't seriously considering this possibility." He was particularly keen to avoid moving his family back to China. Instead, Jack proposed he run Alibaba's R&D team from Fremont, California. John accepted. Jack, with a background as an English teacher, was keen to ensure that his own ignorance of technology was not replicated in Alibaba. "For a first-class company, we need first-class technology. When John comes, I can sleep soundly." Hiring John Wu also gave Jack the opportunity to sprinkle some more Yahoo stardust on his venture. Sitting next to Jack in a press conference, John described Alibaba as a new form of Yahoo. "Yahoo's search engine has shaped the way millions of people surf the internet. Now, Alibaba's e-commerce platform will fundamentally change the way people conduct business online." The Los Angeles Times commented that the ability of a Chinese startup to poach one of Silicon Valley's key players could bolster China's claim as the ultimate internet frontier for the best minds in the industry. John jumped from Yahoo to Alibaba, he explained, because Alibaba's idea was an original one. "If you compare the other leading internet companies in China," he said, "almost all of them are copying business models already existing in the U.S. Shirley Lin at Goldman Sachs had been attracted to Alibaba for its localness. John Wu saw the same merits. "There are a lot of internet companies started by people who studied in the U.S. and came back to China. Jack Ma is different. He has been in China all his life." With fresh capital, new recruits, and more than 150,000 members in 188 countries signed up on the website, things were looking up for Alibaba. But the bubble was about to pop. Chapter 8. Burst and Back to China. Be the last man standing. Jack Ma. By the spring of 2000, Alibaba was signing up more than 1,000 new members a day. Connecting suppliers in China with global buyers was clearly a good idea. But other companies with the same idea were proliferating, and some actively raising capital, too. Meet China raised another $11 million, some of which came from a SoftBank fund, and announced a sales target of $10 million that year and planning for an IPO. Global Sources, the veteran publisher of trade magazines, announced it had hired Goldman Sachs to prepare for a NASDAQ IPO and stepped up its hiring in China. Other contenders entered the fray as well, including entrepreneurs who pivoted to business-to-business e-commerce after seeing Alibaba's success in raising capital. Faced with increasing competition and flush with cash, Alibaba accelerated its expansion. In the months following SoftBank's investment, the company went on a hiring spree in mainland China, Hong Kong, and Fremont, California, where incoming CTO John Wu set up their U.S. outpost. Government on the fence. Speculation grew about an IPO, yet the most likely companies to go public, the three Chinese portals, had hit a roadblock. Their success was helping to popularize the consumer internet faster than the government had expected. 4 million internet users was a drop in the ocean in a population of 1.3 billion. Yet the things that made the portals popular, especially email and news, made a government bent on control increasingly nervous. Within China's ruling Communist Party, a debate was raging over how to handle the internet. Conservatives pointed out that the internet had originated as the project of a U.S. defense agency. They argued that just because it was new, there was no reason to exclude internet companies from the same restrictions that prevented or severely constrained foreign investment in the telecom sector or in print, radio, film, and TV. There was no Ministry of Internet, but the internet touched so many areas that it set off bitter turf battles between existing regulators. To demonstrate their relevance, China's regulators regulate regularly, manifested in the Great Firewall of China, under construction ever since the internet came to China's shore, an unceasing effort to filter content they deemed a threat to the country or to Communist Party rule. At the same time, with its huge investments in telecom infrastructure, the government had actually been pushing Xinhua, informatization, as essential for developing China's economy. There was consensus among the all-powerful Politburo Standing Committee, nearly all trained as engineers, that China needed a knowledge economy. An inability to adapt to new technology could spell disaster. The fall of the Qing Dynasty is popularly attributed in part to its failure to adapt to modern military and industrial technologies, leaving it vulnerable to domination by Western powers. Some in China also blamed the fall of the Soviet Union on a failure to keep up with waves of technological advances in Silicon Valley, such as the semiconductor, computer, and software industries. But the government rejected any notion that the internet would usher in the Western concept of an information society, something they believed could pose an existential threat to the Communist Party. Yet, without foreign investment, how could China's internet entrepreneurs finance their ventures? Restricting them to domestic financing channels was impractical. China's own venture capital market was in its infancy, and its stock markets were dominated by SOEs. In any case, the Shanghai and Shenzhen exchanges required companies to have been in business for at least 3 years and to be profitable. All of China's internet companies were new and operating unashamedly at a loss. China wanted a Silicon Valley, but one that it could control, built on its terms. Yet the distributed, bottom-up nature of the internet was inimical to China's traditions, both imperial and Leninist, of top-down control of information. For those coming online, this was the internet's central appeal. Professor Xu Rongshen, who had helped establish the first connection between the Institute of High Energy Physics in Beijing and Stanford University, describes the impact of the internet as an information bomb exploding over China. Another popular description was that the internet was God's gift to the Chinese, something echoed by investors and dissidents alike. Unable to stop the internet, but nervous about facilitating its rise, how was the government to proceed? How could Chinese internet entrepreneurs raise money overseas without their companies being classified as foreign companies and walled off from businesses in China? To resolve the contradiction, the three portals attempted all manner of contortions to secure government approval for their IPOs, arguing they weren't even internet companies. After months of debate, an accommodation was finally reached, the VIE. The VIE, or Variable Interest Entity, is much loved by corporate lawyers in China for its rich, fee-producing complexity. Still in use today, it allows the Chinese government effectively to have its cake and eat it too, in this case allowing a thriving entrepreneurial internet while maintaining control. The VIE is the subject of ongoing debate for investors in Alibaba. How much protection does it really give them? The structure allows foreign investors a degree of control over the revenues generated by a Chinese company through a complicated arrangement of interlocking contracts that, thanks to the personal engagement of Chinese entrepreneur founders, continues to treat that company as Chinese. The compromise was brokered by Sina and its lawyers with the Ministry of Information Industry, MII, amongst other agencies. MII Minister Wu Jichuan had earlier stood in the way of any portal IPOs, but the VIE broke the logjam. His voice carried weight, as he was the architect of the drive for informatization, the investment in infrastructure without which the country's internet boom would not have been possible. The VIE has its origins in another complicated investment structure that a few years earlier, Wu, ironically, had taken the lead in dismantling. On April 13, 2000, the first of the three Chinese portals finally got its IPO. Sina raised $68 million on the NASDAQ. NetEase and Sohu soon followed. But the portals were to have a very difficult birth as public companies. The reason? The bubble had burst. Bubble ball and burst. From its peak in March 2000, the NASDAQ began a two-year losing streak, wiping out trillions of dollars of market capitalization and taking down many technology firms with it. NetEase's shares dropped 20% on the first day of trading after its IPO in June. Sohu limped to an IPO in July, but after that there would be no more issuances for Chinese internet companies for more than 3 years. The IPO door was now firmly shut to the other Chinese internet companies, including Alibaba, as investors once again cared about revenues and profits. Just as the markets started to tank, and on the fringes of the Internet World Conference in Beijing, I hosted a party at a business club called the Capital Club. I titled the party, as a joke, the Bubble Ball. They say you never know you're in a bubble until it pops. But in the spring of 2000, there was a growing sense that everything was about to come to a crashing halt. For me, the trigger was an event a few weeks after Time magazine ran a cover story on February 28, 2000, on the Chinese internet market, entitled Struggle.com. The opening paragraph was a story I had told to Time journalist Terry McCarthy about my first meeting with one of the portal pioneers. William Ding, founder of NetEase, one of China's top internet portals, was uneasy. As he talked to a friend in a Beijing restaurant last summer, something was irritating him. The air conditioning. It was too cold. Without interrupting the conversation, the self-taught techie took out his Palm Pilot electronic organizer, pointed the infrared port at the aircon unit, and adjusted the temperature from across the room. His friend's jaw dropped. At an extravagant dinner party hosted in Shanghai on the grounds of a colonial-era mansion a few weeks after the Time article ran, an investor came up to introduce herself and told me excitedly about how our host, a senior investment banker, had confided that she, not I, was the friend featured in the article. Wounded ego aside, I started to realize that as the bankers began to invent stories of their closeness to the entrepreneur, the days of the internet boom were numbered. The Bubble Ball name proved more apt than I could have imagined. Jack came along and danced until the small hours, along with Charles Zhang from Sohu, in a unique style that reminded me of Elaine Bennis in Seinfeld. William Ding from NetEase and 400 others in what turned out to be the last party of a short-lived but Gatsby-esque era. CNN and the Australian broadcaster ABC were there to videotape the scene. Viewed today, the graininess of the videos conveys how long ago it was, but also the unbridled exuberance of that time. For Jack, the bursting of the bubble represented a great opportunity for Alibaba. I made a call to our Hangzhou team and said, "Have you heard the exciting news about the NASDAQ? I'd like to have had a bottle of champagne on hand." Adding, "This is healthy for the market, and it's very healthy for companies like us." He felt confident that now the IPO gate had closed, venture capitalists would stop funding Alibaba's competitors. "In the next 3 months, more than 60% of the internet companies in China will close their doors," he said, adding that Alibaba had spent only $5 million of the $25 million it had raised. "We haven't touched our second-round funding. We have lots of gasoline in our tank." With the field opening up, Alibaba increased its hiring of foreign employees to market the company to buyers overseas. Jack started to travel intensively around the world to attend trade shows and meet chambers of commerce. Jack was, by this time, quite familiar with the United States. On his first trips to Europe, though, he experienced some culture shock. I advised Alibaba on its expansion strategy there, recommending a Swiss friend of mine, Abir Orebi, who would oversee the company's European operations for the next 8 years. On his first visit to London, Jack was booked into the city's prestigious Connaught Hotel, but couldn't understand why he had to stay in such an old building. In Zurich, Jack and Kathy were perplexed by the fact that all the shops were closed. Abir explained that it was a Sunday, prompting Kathy to exclaim, "Oh, I see, they're all working second jobs today." Coming from the non-stop business culture of China, the concept of shopkeepers taking a whole day off to rest was unimaginable. Alibaba stepped up its advertising, too. Suddenly, the company's signature orange blanketed print and online media in the mainland, including on the Chinese portals. Alibaba commissioned a glossy television ad that ran on CNBC and CNN, a first for a China-based tech startup. Todd Dom, an American executive who had recently joined Alibaba in Hong Kong, oversaw the production of the video, which Jack described to him jokingly as, "My second favorite video, after Forrest Gump." TV ad campaigns aside, Jack continued to be Alibaba's most effective marketing tool. Despite the dot-com downturn, people came in droves to hear his speeches. When he spoke in Hong Kong in May 2000 at an I&I, Internet and Information Asia, event in the Furama Hotel, more than 500 people turned up. Jack was gaining profile overseas, too, invited as a global internet luminary to an internet event in Barcelona, Spain. As Alibaba surpassed the 300,000 member mark, Jack was featured on the cover of Forbes Global magazine, which named the company, along with global sources, as Best of the Web for B2B e-commerce. That was followed by a full-page profile in The Economist titled "The Jack Who Would Be King." But as the stock market continued its downward slide, enthusiasm for internet companies of any description began to dwindle. In August 2000, NetEase's shares sank below a third of their IPO price, and Sohu's under half. In late July, only 5 months after a blockbuster Hong Kong IPO, the local portal Tom.com, backed by billionaire Li Ka-shing, laid off 80 employees. China.com followed suit soon after. The internet conferences started to thin out. I&I even dropped the word internet, and then faded into oblivion, along with many of the companies that had once presented at its events. .com had become .bomb. At a venture capital investor conference in Hong Kong that fall, Jack was one of the featured speakers. In a dramatic reversal from the crowds that Jack had drawn just a few months earlier, Goldman Sachs had to scramble to find people to fill an empty conference room to hear his pitch. Standing at the podium in front of a skeptical audience, an investor recounted to me, Jack cupped his hands in front of his face, squinted his eyes, and declared, "I can see the end of the tunnel." But in the face of growing investor cynicism about the sector, Jack magic was wearing off. Meanwhile, in California, Alibaba's efforts to build an R&D center under John Wu's leadership were running into problems. In an effort to overhaul the company's disparate software platforms, Alibaba had hired more than 30 engineers in its new Fremont office, but coordinating with their colleagues in China across a 15-hour time difference was proving a headache. Forced to use English for the benefit of non-Chinese-speaking colleagues in California, Chinese engineers in both offices struggled to communicate among themselves. The team started to fracture, and tempers frayed as Hangzhou pushed to develop one product and Fremont another. After an infrastructure upgrade, the whole Alibaba.com site went down. Jack was visiting Fremont at the time and had to step in personally to force better cooperation between the two teams so that the problem could be fixed. It was clear that splitting the technology team across the Pacific had failed. Alibaba started to move core functions back to Hangzhou. Alibaba was about to embark on a new defensive strategy, B2C, or Back to China. Pressures were mounting on Jack, including from his first investor Goldman Sachs, to prove that Alibaba could actually make money. Alibaba.com has a revenue plan for today, tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow, Jack commented. Today we are focused on revenues from online marketing services. Tomorrow we will add revenue sharing with third-party service providers, and the day after tomorrow we will add transaction-based revenues. To reassure investors and his team, Alibaba agreed to look at offering third-party services such as credit, transport, and insurance services. Together, these accounted for as much as $300 billion in annual revenues on total global trade of $7 trillion. Grabbing even a small slice of this pie could be extremely lucrative. This was the strategy already touted by Meet China. The company claimed that more than 70,000 Chinese suppliers and 15,000 prospective purchasers had joined its site. Although few transactions had been facilitated online, it disclosed it planned to take 2-6% of all transactions on its site. Bucking the investment downturn, Meet China surprised the market with a fresh venture capital infusion of $30 million, taking its total haul to over $40 million, some $15 million more than Alibaba. Co-founder Thomas Rosenthal told reporters, "The volatility of the NASDAQ actually made it relatively easier to get private financing. You have a large amount of money chasing fewer deals." Recently appointed CEO Len Cordiner pursued a vision for the site as a place where you can not only find buyers, but also negotiate online. But Meet China would never make much headway in China. Talking up partnerships with third parties was much easier than making them work, and many of the tie-ups ending up being nothing more than links to its partners' websites. A former employee later summed up Meet China's experience as spending $30 million to train Chinese enterprises to use the internet. Eventually, the company switched focus to Southeast Asia, launching MeetPhilippines.com and MeetVietnam.com in the presence of President Clinton, and inking partnerships in India, Indonesia, South Korea, and Thailand before it folded. Jack had long been dismissive of Meet China, and as it fell to the wayside, he turned his guns on global sources, now Alibaba's main rival, and its founder, Merle Hinrichs. Jack dismissed global sources as an old economy company that had misunderstood the nature of online trade. They are a company pushing a publication. Merle Hinrichs in turn dismissed Alibaba as a mile wide and half an inch deep. Although global sources, recently listed shares, had tanked along with the NASDAQ, it was buoyed by substantial profits generated from its offline print business. Later in 2000, Jack and Hinrichs were both keynote speakers at an internet conference in Hong Kong. Although he never referred to Hinrichs by name, Jack later told a story about a rival who owned a beautiful yacht, who after paying a $50,000 fee to be a keynote speaker, was incensed to find that Jack had been invited to give a keynote speech without having to pay a fee. The conference organizers explained to his rival, so Jack's story goes, that it is because you want to be a keynote speaker, but the audience wants Jack Ma to speak. To which his rival vowed, "I will sail the yacht to Hong Kong and will invite all the keynote speakers and speakers of the conference to have a party on my yacht, but I have one condition, that Jack Ma is not allowed." Merle Hinrichs' office declined to comment on the spat, but the rivalry is something that Jack, the philosopher CEO, invested with a deeper meaning. If you can't tolerate your opponents, you will be definitely beaten by your opponent. If you treat your opponents as enemies, you have already lost at the beginning of the game. If you hang your opponent as a target and practice throwing darts at him every day, you are only able to fight this one enemy, not others. Competition is the greatest joy. When you compete with others and find that it brings you more and more agony, there must be something wrong with your competition strategy. But in the latter half of 2000, it looked like there was something wrong with Alibaba's strategy. Although it had raised $25 million and signed up more than 500,000 users, its revenues that year wouldn't even hit the $1 million mark. Alibaba did start to charge some fees, helping build and host websites for some of its members, but expenses were increasing far more rapidly than revenues. Alibaba's hiring spree was creating more problems than it solved, as new recruits arrived before reporting and budgeting systems had been put in place. The international nature of its business was also a challenge, both in dealing with clients and in managing human resources. Trying to market a Chinese company with an Arabic name to clients in the United States and Europe wasn't proving easy, and Jack admitted that managing a multinational organization is no easy task with the language and cultural gaps. As the tech downturn continued into 2001, Jack and Joe recognized that things needed to change. In January 2001, they brought on board as Chief Operating Officer Savio Kwan, a 52-year-old veteran of GE, who gave a frank assessment of the company. "We need to ground Alibaba in reality and make it into a business." Back to China. Kwan's arrival heralded a new management structure that became known internally as the Four O's: Jack as CEO, Joe Tsai as CFO, John Wu as CTO, and Savio Kwan as COO. To signal to the company how serious he was about change, Jack divided his own office in Hangzhou in two, giving the other half to Kwan. Kwan slashed monthly expenses by as much as half, stepping up the back-to-China retrenchment. A joint venture in South Korea was scrapped, and Alibaba's Silicon Valley presence drastically scaled back. Many of the higher-paid foreign employees were let go. Expensive advertising campaigns were abandoned and replaced with word-of-mouth marketing. Reducing expenses overseas allowed Alibaba to increase its hiring at home, leveraging Hangzhou's deep pool of lower-cost talent. It rapidly expanded its sales team to focus on promoting fee-paying services such as TrustPass, which provided credit information and authentication services, and Gold Supplier, which gave exporters in China their own presence on Alibaba's English-language website. For $3,600, they could use this to display their products and prices and be linked to Alibaba's search engine. Gold Supplier was explicitly designed to undercut the $10,000 to $12,000 in annual fees that Global Sources charged for its online listings. Despite the early promise from these new revenue sources, Alibaba was taking a beating. Since it was still a private company, the negative sentiment couldn't be measured in dollars and cents, unlike the three portals, whose shares had by now been reduced to penny stocks. Businessweek ran an article in April 2001 titled, "Alibaba's Magic Carpet is Losing Altitude," which concluded that the former professor will have to work hard to ensure his company doesn't flunk out. The company had initiated a restructuring that it hoped would turn things around, but in the years following the dot-com crash, Alibaba was resigned to a very uncertain future. Jack even floated the prospect of quitting so he could return to teaching before he turned 40. In his darker moments, he took to comparing his struggles to those of the revolutionary Mao Zedong after the Long March, even calling for a rectification movement to set Alibaba on a new course. Once many well-known managers in America came to Alibaba to be vice presidents. Each of them had their own opinions. It was like a zoo at the time. Some were good at talking, while others were quiet. Therefore, we think the most important purpose of a rectification movement is to decide a shared purpose of Alibaba and determine our value. Alibaba's reversal of fortunes had been dramatic, but it didn't break the bond between Jack and Joe Tsai. I asked Joe what kept him at Alibaba when everything seemed so bleak. "Alibaba," he explained, "was my fourth job. I wanted this job to work." Unlike the three portals, Joe also saw the advantages for Alibaba of not having had an IPO. "I knew all of this was a bubble, and even if we had gone public in 2000, we would have to live with the consequences, the delivery. You would have had to grow into your valuation. It was a quick buck kind of thing." The dark days of 2001 and 2002 would later become part of Alibaba lore. Jack later referred to the period in one of his pep talks to the team. "At that time, my slogan was, be the last man standing, be the last person to fall down. Even on my knees, I had to be the last man collapsing. I also believed firmly at that time that if I had difficulties, there must be someone who had worse difficulties. If I had a hard time, my opponents had an even harder time. Those who can stand and manage will win eventually." In the years that followed the dot-com crash, Alibaba slashed costs and found a way to steadily increase its revenues. Even though the venture capital market had dried up completely, Alibaba was able to stand on its own 2 feet. And, thanks to a new business launched in the spring of 2003, it was about to succeed on a scale that even Jack could never have imagined.